Welcome to the Can Be Now podcast.
We are the best and easiest way to stay connected to what's happening in your hometown. I'm Tyler Frankie.
And I'm Tyler Clausen. In this episode, we get outside of Canby to meet someone from Canby. So chill out, one star rating. We catch up with our new state representative, Christine Drazen, in her new digs at the state capitol. If you're like us, you started hearing words like cap and trade a lot, which just made us excited for trading bottle caps again. But Christine explains what that actually means and why it concerns her. And we'll be jumping back into our history series, Canby Then, as we bring you the story of Canby City Council's very first meeting. It was a fascinating time when the citizens and their elected officials didn't always quite see eye to eye on the direction of the town's development and the conditions of the local roads. So I guess not that much has changed. But first, the news! Love it or hate it, trains are a part of life in downtown Gambia. It's been that way for over 100 years, and it's not likely to change anytime soon. What about some of the noises that the trains make? Federal law requires that train engineers have to use their horn multiple times as they approach any road crossing. This happens 3 times in downtown Gambia: South Elm, South Grant, and South Ivy Street. Translation: whenever a train goes through in Canby, everyone knows about it. However, it is possible that a quiet zone could be established at these 3 crossings. This would allow trains to lay off the horn as they pass through downtown. It's something the city, with the support and encouragement of the downtown businesses and community, have been working towards for years. A critical piece of the puzzle will come before the Canby City Council this week, as they, in their role as Canby Urban Renewal Agency, will consider an agreement with Union Pacific Railroad for a site and design review associated with the proposed quiet zone improvements. The railroad requires that their staff conduct their own review of the proposal. There is a catch. They also require that their costs be reimbursed by the city at an estimated price tag of $75,000. Unfortunately, if the city agrees to reimburse the costs, there is no guarantee that Union Pacific will approve the quiet zone. But it is guaranteed that the quiet zone won't move forward at all unless they agree to pony up the dough. Following his State of the City address last week, Mayor Brian Hodson fielded a question about the quiet zone saga and said essentially, it's now or never.
So we are currently working at getting ready to do engineering pieces. We have upgrades at Elm Street that need to be done, which is a partnership with Elm and PGE. So it is coming right now. Is our best chance to get that done. We have everybody seeming to come together and wanting to work on it. And so if we can't get it done now, I don't know if we'll ever get it done. So we are working really hard at getting it done.
The $75,000 expenditure will be considered at the Urban Renewal Agency's meeting on Wednesday night, immediately following the City Council meeting in Council Chambers. The city of Canby looks like it will soon have a team in place to provide preliminary design and other engineering services to build a new traffic signal at the main entrance to the Canby Market Center on Sequoia Parkway, which is anchored by the Canby Fred Meyer. In addition to the construction of the 4-way traffic signals, the project may include some redesign and realignment of the existing curbs and ADA improvements at all 4 corners in the intersection. The lead engineer will be Curran McLeod Incorporated. They and their team have negotiated a proposed contract for services of just under $114,000, which the Canby City Council will also consider at the Urban Renewal Agency meeting on Wednesday. If approved, their work would start right away with an estimated completion date in June. A bid process for the actual construction would immediately follow. Construction is expected to take 6 to 7 months, with the goal of having a new signal operating by the end of 2019. The demand for educated, technically skilled workers is higher than ever thanks to advancing technology and an aging workforce. Now, and don't be shocked, but the field of electronics, engineering technology is partially in need of an ever-increasing level of technical talents. To address this, Clackamas Community College, CCC, is now offering an electronics engineering technology program which trains students for careers of engineering technician, manufacturing equipment technician, field services technician, operator, and processor with large and small employees in high-tech industries. According to the United States Department of Labor, a median annual salary for electrical and electronics engineering technicians is $63,660. CCC instructor Mike Farrell says if you like taking electronics equipment apart and putting it back together, working with your hands and problem solving, the electronics engineering technology is for you. The demand for those who can create, understand, and alter electrical control systems puts electronic engineers at the cutting edge of the technology sector. CCC's hands-on learning environment gives electronics engineering technology students the fundamentals in electronics, digital logic, troubleshooting, and schematics. The colleges also offer a number of transferable classes into Oregon Tech's electronics engineering technology degree program. For more information, visit www.clackamas.edu/EET. Betty Reynolds of Westland was appointed to the Clackamas Community College Board of Education January 9th. She is filling the position vacated by the retirement of Ron Adams in December, representing the Westland-Wilsonville area. Reynolds also serves on the Westland-Wilsonville School Board and will complete the remainder of her term, which expires June 30th. She has been active with the college for several years, serving twice as chair for the Budget Committee as a member of the Bond Project Citizen Oversight Committee. Reynolds also serves on the Oregon School Boards Association Board of Directors and is a past president. She represents the association on the Oregon Community Colleges Association Board. Betty has been involved in public education advocacy for many years and volunteers as a legislative advocate for college, CCC President Tim Cook says. We are privileged to have someone as experienced and dedicated as her to serve our college, our students, and our community. Reynolds says she sees the 2019 Oregon legislature session as promising for public education opportunities so that all students succeed and Oregon thrives. Reynolds will be sworn in at the February 19th Board of Education meeting. Her appointment will continue through June 30th. In May, Reynolds may run for election to the position. In Cougar basketball this week, each game has heavy implications as the playoff picture solidifies and both boys and girl teams are on the bubble. The girls split their games this week, falling to West Lynn 51-75, but beating Tualatin 52-48. They have a league record of 5-7, heading into their final two games as they take on Lake Oswego on Tuesday and wrap up on the road against St. Mary's Academy on Friday. They're currently ranked 32nd among 6A schools, and with 32 playoff spots, they are well positioned to make the postseason. The boys have a little bit of a longer shot. They're at 36th, with only one game remaining. They'll be on the road Tuesday against Lake Oswego. Are you a small business owner or maybe thinking of investing in yourself with your very own startup? Awesome! Now all you have to do is reach potential customers at a time when consumers have never been more fragmented, more distracted, or more difficult to reach. If that sounds hard, believe me, it is. That's why I make Frankie do it.
Carrie and her team at Promotional Strategies offer strategic, purposeful solutions to build your brand with lasting promotional items that make sense for you and your company. They are creative geniuses who will deliver advertisements that people actually thank you for and will use every day. We've tried other sellers, and we trust Carrie to provide high-quality branded items that we can be proud of. Find them at 695 Southeast 1st Avenue in Canby or online at ps266swag.com. Yeah. a very special guest for you guys today. You may remember her as one of the few candidates in this most recent election cycle to run a classy, positive campaign that didn't make you want to scream or cry or start looking at house prices in Canada. She's one of the newest members of the Oregon House of Representatives representing Canby and the surrounding area. It's Christine Drazen.
Hi.
Hi, Christine. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for coming all the way to Salem.
Yeah, all the way to Salem, right? Because that's where you work now.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm a commuter now. It's official.
Yeah, I guess we talked to you on election night about wanting to do some type of interview on the podcast at some point, and now here we are, like 4 months later, we're finally able to schedule it. So you've been pretty busy. How's it been going?
It's been really, really good. Mm-hmm. It's been a different pace.
Yeah.
Because once you're in the building, all of a sudden you're in the world of advocates.
You just get thrown in, right?
Yeah.
Into this machine a little bit, does it feel like?
It is a machine. You know, the incredible thing about the state capitol here is it really is an institution.
Yeah.
And there are more than 50 people just working in committee services to just support the process for the public to come and comment on bills. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, dozens of people in each of the specialty offices to look at the budgets and look at the proposals around taxes. So the place itself is like maxed out, running full tilt all the time. Mm-hmm, and then you're just newly elected and you just get dropped in an office and just join the hamster wheel with everybody else.
Right. And each representative and each senator has their own staff and their own policies and things that they're looking to do. It's crazy how much bustle and things, you know, coalesce into hopefully some positive things for the people of Oregon. So
that is what we're here to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Have there been any challenges that you found in this first couple months, or what have been some of those?
The biggest challenge for me so far has been, I guess, partially in the committee process. Mm. There's this tension for a committee chair who really wants to have a really full agenda every single day.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I just want to move, you know, you see that agenda and you're thinking, how in the world are we going to take public testimony on 6 or 7 bills in the next, you know, 65, 75 minutes or whatever we've got left after, you know, after things get rolling. Mm-hmm. And it just, I think that's been the challenge for me so far has been, how do I really feel like the public's being heard in this process if things are really, really rushed? Mm-hmm. And we're only a few weeks into the formal session. So it kind of worries me a little bit as far as process goes in that way.
Yeah, yeah. Because your background was, you were on the County Planning Commission, I believe, and Canby School Board Budget or
I did Budget Committee. So I'm on the Planning Commission now.
Yeah.
And I did do Budget Committee.
Oh, still on Planning Commission.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And I had a Planning Commission meeting last night.
Oh, okay.
But so before that, I was a staff person in this building. Mm. So I've been on the hamster wheel before. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And so I do have a little bit of experience from that perspective, kind of on the other side of the desk.
Yeah.
But things have changed a lot. It's pretty ambitious for how much they want to push through.
Yeah, well, that's one thing I was going to say, like, because I work down here as well, so I see some meetings, you know, and I think that is a big difference from if some of the listeners are kind of City Hall watchers and follow Canby City, they'll have, like, one issue that if it's a contentious thing, that's a 4-hour meeting, you know what I mean? Because they do let everybody be heard. And I think that does happen here as well, like, people get heard, but it is much more like, especially some of the chairs are real quick about things, you know, they do churn things through. So it is a little jarring if you're more used to the city or even the county approach. And then you see a state meeting and it's like, whoa, that's it. That was the decision. We're moving on. So, yeah,
it can be like that. Last week we had a bill that I don't know if it's going to move or not.
Yeah.
But these folks drove up from Grants Pass.
Mm.
Yeah. And there was a panel, and they, you know, they drove a long time, and it was in the bad weather.
Yeah.
And they got up there, and the committee chair held them to their 3 minutes or less.
Right.
And I just felt
so bad
for them. Mm-hmm. And so you hope that they're prepared for that and that they can still submit information online, but, you know, it feels a little bit, it feels a little bit unnecessarily tight.
Yeah, that's tough. Yeah, but if you make an exception for them, it's like, oh, well, these people didn't quite come from Grants Pass, but what about them? Or, you know, and then it's like, where does it end?
Where does it end?
Yeah, so it's tough.
Mm-hmm.
So some exciting news. We have actually this year in the Oregon legislature a record number of women lawmakers who were elected. 37, I believe, is the number between the House and Senate. And it's cool that you get to be part of that. Mm-hmm. Does that dynamic, you obviously have no necessarily basis for comparison, but do you feel like that dynamic is at play a little bit and maybe some of the policies that you guys are looking at or anything like that?
So I have really been... Since this is my first term,
right.
This will be my new normal.
Yeah.
And I found it to be really collaborative.
Yeah.
And really positive to have
such a... You're
not
getting boys club vibes or anything like that? Yeah.
It feels like anywhere else you'd go out in the public realm where there's a bunch of women and there's a bunch of men and there's people that are younger and older.
Yeah.
And
just sort of like a normal office type environment.
Yeah, it's just normal.
People working together.
Yeah, and so from that perspective, it doesn't seem extraordinary to me.
Yeah.
And I'm glad, though, to not really be in the position to be the only female or anything like that. I think that would feel a little bit different getting rolling.
Yeah.
But it just feels 100% normal like anywhere else you go at work. It's a real mix.
Yeah, cool, cool. So smaller numbers now. You are a Republican, one of, I think, three. No, I'm just kidding. It's a little more than that. But, so the Democrats have a super majority this year. That's the three-fifths. Can you explain a little bit about what that means and for your own party, the Republicans, is that kind of frustrating, or how do you work with that that supermajority?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. It is, I think that politics, like a lot of other businesses, are a lot about relationships. And the idea that my particular party has such small numbers compared to the other party.
Yeah.
Means that I need to do a good job of making my case for my community. I also kind of have to do it in a way that allows people to even be willing to work with me.
Yeah.
And I think that, the thing that most people don't realize is that what that whole term supermajority means is that our Constitution puts kind of a threshold in there for raising taxes.
Yeah.
And it's 36 people, so you have to have 36 votes in the House and 18 votes in the Senate to be able to raise taxes. Well, on both sides, the Democrats have more than enough votes to be able to do that on both sides of this body.
And so basically, no Republican would have to join in that vote. If it's just along party lines, like the Democrats could get it done just on their own. That's what that means.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that really is the biggest distinction there.
Yeah.
And that for our committees, our committees end up being equally appointed based on party.
Okay.
And so that means that our healthcare committee, for example, will have seven Democrats to four Republicans. And in prior sessions, those numbers would have been a little bit closer than they are now.
Yeah.
So it just means that you really have to look at things in a way that is as collaborative as you can be and represent your community as well as you can with the numbers that that are here. But it's about building relationships, I think.
Cool. Well, that's good to hear that it's not frustrating. I think that you might imagine that, like, this, you know, being in the minority, like sort of the token minority, can be just kind of like, why am I even here?
Yes.
Like, we can't get stuff done. But it's cool that you seem like you're approaching it like, okay, well, I am here. Mm-hmm. Like, let's see how maybe creatively I can still get some stuff done, still let my voice and the things that are important to my constituents be heard. So
yeah, and I think the message that I have been trying to share at every opportunity to folks that are in leadership and do carry that mantle of leadership at this time for our state is I have an obligation to represent everybody in my community, whether they voted for me or not.
Right.
And if you, in some way, create a process or a system that blocks me out from doing that, then they're all disenfranchised. Yeah. They're all shut out of the process, and that's just not fair to them.
Right.
And
right.
so I am super clear about the fact that I have an obligation to them to be a part of the solutions that move our state forward, and I have an obligation to them to represent their concerns in a way that is heard. It doesn't mean that I'm always going to win the day. It might not change the vote, but I absolutely have an obligation to be a part of the conversation not be shut out of that.
Right. That's true. It's not just the 30 or so electeds that are part of this. I mean, each one of those elected officials represents hundreds of thousands of people whose voices are not being heard if they are literally just being shut out. So
Our 22 Republican members, it's a good geographic swath of the state as well.
Yeah, for
sure. But for each of our districts, it's around 65,000 people that we each have the incredible distinction and opportunity and honor to be able to represent. So I take that very seriously.
Yeah, cool. Well, let's talk about cap and trade. So words that I think folks who have been following the news are starting to hear a lot, or have been following the session has come out up a lot. But I wonder if, especially maybe my younger generation who maybe don't follow the news or follow the legislatures closely, don't even know what that means. Like, it doesn't even necessarily is like super clear the words, what's it even referring to? Like, it sounds like maybe it's something that's very economic or something. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about what it is, and then maybe a little of your position on it and some of your concerns.
So I'm going to start with this idea that I think you're right. Cap and trade doesn't, they're not words that mean it, that have any meaning yet.
Right. They sound very legislature-y.
Like, huh?
Why?
Right. What are you talking about?
Not very concerning either. Like, they're very innocuous sounding words.
Yes, they are. So. But the impact from those innocuous sounding words is that our prices to heat our homes are projected to go up 50%.
Yeah.
And I cannot imagine paying 50% more for my house to be able to turn on the heat in the winter.
Yeah.
And that our gas prices are going to go up a minimum of 16 cents a gallon just to start, and they could go up considerably higher. So cap and trade is this system, and it's a new system where people in our state, not entities that emit carbon for how their businesses run, they're going to be given a certain amount of carbon that they can pump out, and that's
carbon
the cap.
Credits, right?
So they're given the amount of carbon that they can emit is capped.
Okay.
And then if they exceed that, then they have to buy
the credits.
A credit to be able to go above that.
Okay.
And for some people, they're given these things called allowances, which is a freebie to say you don't have to change practice and we're not going to charge you for those credits.
Yeah.
We want either the market to catch up or innovation to catch up to allow you to have, you know, emit less carbon. But at the end of the day, there are all these systems in place for this proposed legislation that basically has Oregon jumping into this cap and trade thing that California's been doing before us.
Right.
California, as everybody knows, is a massive economy, right?
Yeah.
And they have all these rules in place, and we are doing this to really join something called the Western Climate Initiative. And it's not about what's best for Oregon. This proposal is about jumping into something that's already in place for California and a province up in Canada.
Yeah.
And for the folks who support it, I do hear a lot of people say we have to do something about climate.
Right.
And I totally agree with that.
I was going to say you wouldn't disagree
with
wanting to protect the, you know, wanting to reduce our carbon footprint and wanting to protect the environment and the impact we're having. So it's just a matter of how to do that.
Is this the best way? And I think that what people don't realize too is that Oregon is already the third lowest carbon emitter in the whole nation.
Right.
And our carbon emissions globally are, like, I think it's 0.14% or something. It's just nominal. But besides that, Oregon is already a leader in all kinds of policies that haven't been fully implemented. We have a clean fuel standard in Oregon.
Yeah.
We have very ambitious carbon goals even to begin with. We're already a leader in this category. So I think people should feel like they can be very proud of the work Oregon's already doing in support of our climate goals, which is terrific. But cap and trade is really mostly about leadership that's philosophical and won't actually change climate. But what it will do is drive up all of our costs to heat our homes and turn on our heaters and get in our cars and drive everywhere, unfortunately.
Yeah. I have a concern about it as well, like that aspect of it, that it doesn't seem that it really sets or really requires less carbon. It just punishes you for using it, you know what I mean? And then ends up raising all this revenue and going to projects that our leadership wants, but are kind of, maybe some are kind of more experimental. We don't really have a good idea of how this actually changes the carbon footprint that we're putting out there, other than just raising a lot of money to go toward green projects. So
and the bummer about that too, though, is that this money isn't even all dedicated to green projects and to our forests. And,
okay, I didn't even realize that aspect, yeah.
It really is about pet projects. Mm-hmm. And where the money gets spent isn't even going to be decided by people who are in elected office. It's going to be decided by people who are appointed by the governor.
Okay.
And it's a list of, and the categories aren't even all scientists.
Yeah.
So they're not elected, they're not scientists, and it's appointed groups of folks that are going to spend more than $1 billion every couple of years on whatever they think is the right thing to spend that money on.
Yeah.
So it is a pretty substantial system that they're putting in place. And I just, at this point, I'm pretty concerned that it doesn't meet the objectives that Oregonians would want it to meet, as in it has to be fair, it has to really improve our climate.
Yeah.
We have to, this has to really make a difference. And mostly it just raises a lot of money at this point.
Yeah, yeah. So we're almost out of time, but if folks do hear this, get a little worried, like, I don't want to spend 50% more on my heating costs or 16 cents more per gallon at the pump. Are there ways that they can get involved, or would you say just kind of inform yourself about the issue?
I'm so glad you asked. Mm-hmm. The legislature has just created a series of public hearings all across Oregon.
Oh, okay, great.
And so there will be opportunities for them to come and testify one way or another as far as how they think that they will be impacted by this, what they think about the structures and the systems that are being proposed right now.
Yeah.
And the best way to get involved is to say something and to show up and to share your story. Like, can you afford to take your kids to school and go to work and have all these new expenses put on there? Is it worth it to you for what you may or may not get as far as climate benefit? That's really who we need to hear from. We need to hear from Oregonians right now. They're the ones who are really going to pay the final bill on this.
Yeah, cool. Well, Christine, thank you so much. Definitely, guys, read up on that issue and get involved, because this is something that's really going to affect us, or potentially. Thanks so much for making time for us, Christine. I really enjoyed this, and I guess I got to get out of here. I think there are people beating down the door to get in here next.
Come back anytime.
Yeah, absolutely.
For times, dates, and locations of the statewide public hearings to discuss the proposed cap and trade plan, see the link on the show notes for today's episode. Located just off the corner of 13th and South Ivy is one of the most magical places on earth, Puddin' River Chocolates. That's where Chief Chocolatier Teresa Sassy and her team of employees hand make some of the richest, most delicious gourmet chocolates you can find anywhere. Yeah, that's right. Willy Wonka wishes he was this good. Teresa uses the highest quality free trade cocoa from around the globe and locally sourced hazelnuts, berries, and other ingredients to create world-class confections that are a treat to the eyes and the taste buds. And they do more than chocolate. The classic fondue is an ideal blend of Swiss cheese, wine, and spices that you have got to try. Puddin' River's creations make a great gift for a loved one, or hey, for yourself, because you know what? You deserve it. I deserve it, Frankie! Find them at PuddinRiverChocolates.com.
Hey, I'm Steve, owner of the FOB Tap Room in Canby.
And I'm Jen, the head bartender.
FOB stands for Friends of Beer, and that's what we are. It's even on my business card.
He's not kidding, it really is.
What?
Oh, nothing. Beer is practically an art form in the Pacific Northwest, and the FOB is the best place to enjoy all of your old favorites and even find some new ones. We have a constantly rotating selection of 36 of the best craft beers, ciders, and wines from right here in Oregon and around the world.
We also host an awesome trivia night on Wednesdays with tap takeovers and new release parties every month. There's always something going on here, so please come on by. We'd love to see you.
Find us in Canby Place on Southwest Berg Parkway and on Facebook and Instagram.
See you at the FOB!
Canby Then is brought to you by Retro Revival. They're not your average antique shop. Open daily, you'll find them on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Grant in downtown Canby. It was May of 1893. The Canby City Council was meeting for the first time in a cramped and cluttered room above the store owned by the city pioneer William Knight. But more on him in a moment. The council paid a handsome sum of $1.25 per month for the privilege, and that was just part of the problem. Running a city is expensive, and their coffers were completely empty. Their bills at that meeting totaled $35.50, which is called a cheap date today, but back then it must have seemed almost insurmountable. The mayor and recorder were directed to procure $100 to pay the debt and cover the first year's expenses. Why become a city at all? I wonder how often Canby's first elected leaders asked themselves that question. A scant 200 souls called the newly incorporated city home, and only 63 of them had voted in the town's first election, held just a few days earlier. But 15 other cities, including the neighboring Aurora, had been incorporated during the legislative session of 1893, and Canby joined the trend. Small or not, Canby was experiencing some issues that incorporation would allow the city to address. Canby already had 3 hotels, the Carlton, the Rosencrantz Department Store, which would remain the city's largest for over 60 years, and several taverns, which drew rowdy loggers from outlying camps. The regulation of, quote, spiritus liquors, which, in my opinion, is the best kind of liquors, was the top agenda item in the council's first few meetings. Also, even in 1893, the sprawl was already becoming a problem. Not the kind of sprawl that you're thinking of. This is more the type of sprawl where your less clean, considerate neighbors and their junk collection starts to encroach on your carefully manicured lawn. That kind of sprawl. You see, the 24 blocks that once comprised the entirety of Canby had been deliberately and painstakingly laid out by Philander Lee and Co. filed the city's first plat in 1870. But for many years after, those lines and streets were more hypothetical than anything else. The city council spent much of its first few years of business convincing residents to move chicken coops and fences, gardens and trees so the platted streets could be graded and wood curbs could be put in. The council had to repeatedly consider ordinances designed to pull reluctant property owners into compliance. Bet you never knew how close downtown Canby came to having chicken coops for bike racks instead of the stylish flowers we have today. Other earlier ordinances addressed problems with peddlers, eating establishments, gambling, and other entertainment. They might have had an easier job with it if they had been able to keep the police chief on payroll. Early Canby changed police chiefs as about as often as folks change their underwear. The $1 a month salary, paltry even in those days, probably didn't help. When repairing sidewalks and lighting the city's new street lamps became part of the job in 1895, the council reluctantly agreed to increase the pay to $4 a month. Let's return to the subject of William Knight, Canby's second most well-known and influential founding patriarch, to have an elementary school named after him. His story intertwines somewhat with that of Dr. William Kyle, founder of the German Lutheran communes that formed Aurora, Oregon, and Bethel, Missouri, William Knight's hometown. Knight traveled west from Bethel in 1863 with his father, Joseph Sr., and his 4 brothers, George, John, Adam, and Joseph Jr. The family had ties to the Aurora colony, but was never very active in it. Instead, Joseph Sr. settled in Canby on land near the Mallala River. He died in 1872, but all of his sons would remain in the area to make their mark on the blossoming town and help Canby grow, with the exception of John, who moved to the Hubbard area. William was an early railroad agent and opened Knight Mercantile in 1871, across the street from the railroad depot. And for those listeners who weren't alive in 1870s, a mercantile is just a 5-cent word for a general store. In 1875, he built the area's first schoolhouse on Baker Prairie. From 1875 until his death in 1922, he served as clerk of the Baker Prairie and Canby school districts. He also served 2 terms as Clackamas County Sheriff and was postmaster from 1877 to 1884. He was one of the prime movers responsible for the push to incorporate Canby, and he did his part to make it successful, serving as the city's first recorder and a justice of the peace. He wasn't the only good knight in Canby either. His brother Adam Knight was our first blacksmith, and like most blacksmiths, also an entrepreneur. He built the Knight Hotel, which should have been called the Goodnight Hotel, which overlooked the 1877 Knights Bridge over the Mallala River. Yep, shocker here, but the Knights Bridge and Knightsbridge Road were named after one of the knights, Adam Sr., who owned the land the original span was built on. The original was a charming covered bridge built by Clackamas County, but it was condemned in 1944 and would be blown into the Mooloolah River by a storm 3 years later. The loss of the bridge, compounded by the loss of the ferry service during the same period, caused the inconvenience and isolation of Canby. Knight's Bridge would be rebuilt by the county in 1964, slightly downriver from the original bridge. Adam Sr.'s son, Adam H. Knight, was twice mayor of Canby and Clackamas County Commissioner and served as the city's postmaster for 23 years. He wasn't the first postmaster. That honor belongs to his uncle, Charles Knight, better known as Doc, who also owned and operated a drugstore on Grant Street. You'd think we'd be done with our series on Canby's movers and shakers, but forget about it. We've got loads more, and way more stories that we want to tell. But you'll have to wait till next time on Canby Then. More than 1.2 million Americans receive internet, TV, and telephone services from community cooperatives like Direct Link. They believe that their role revolves around partnerships, whether sponsoring a local event, hosting educational classes, or investing in fiber internet technology. Direct Link is here for our community because they are a part of our community.
Beyond just working in Canby, most of DirectLink's employees live here as well. DirectLink's investment in the local area reaches past business interests and extends into the everyday lives of neighbors, friends, and families. Visit them online at directlink.coop to learn more about their communication services and community activities.
And that's our show. Special thanks to our guest today, Christine Drazen, and to all of our sponsors who really make it possible to do what we do. We encourage you to check them out and help support the local small businesses who support us. Hey, if you like what you just heard, please let us know. Write a review for us on Facebook, iTunes, or your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss our latest episode. Miss our next episode? You wouldn't dare. Yeah. It's Todd Cook of the TMK Creamery. We'll talk about how its wonderful Canby family operation was born out of a 12-year-old's love for his pet dairy cow. It's kind of like Charlotte's Web, but, you know, believable. If you have a news tip, an idea for a guest we should invite on the program, or suggestions of how we can improve, please contact us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CanbyNow, or on our website, canbynowpod.com.